From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. David Moore is principal of Nelson and Colne College in Lancashire, Northern England. He's also an education advisor to Granada Television International, one of Great Britain's commercial TV networks. I talked with Mr. Moore about education in the United Kingdom and the United States. Joining in our conversation is John Caldwell, Chancellor Emeritus of North Carolina State University in Raleigh.
We've always tended to reserve education for the privileged in society, and it's come to be seen as a way of climbing society's ladder. The problem is, it's been damn difficult to get on the ladder to begin with. And the successive generations have always tried to reserve higher education for, if you like, the controlling class of the time.
Do educators in Great Britain tend to put it candidly, look down their noses at the higher education system in the United States because it's open to so many people and because so many people...
I think there's a tendency to do that. It depends what kind of academics you're talking about. I mean, I've learned in my visits over the last 5 years and in my work at the college where we've had many American faculty over there, that whereas in the UK, if I have an applicant from any university to join the faculty, at whatever level, bachelor's, master's, doctorate, I know pretty precisely what his academic standards are going to be. You can't say that of an applicant from the United States, because if he or she is from one of your more distinguished universities, then we have no problems at all. But of course, there's no nationwide standard of vetting. For example, to become a university in England, you need to have a royal charter. It's extremely difficult. Whereas over here, a state can establish, I understand, as many universities as it likes. And given that, there's bound to be a more patchy provision.
But David, in the 1960s, you did establish some new universities in England.
We did indeed.
Did they all come into being with the standards of Oxford and Cambridge, for example?
I think they all came into being with certain basic standards. Certainly the intellectual rigor applied to the students was the equal of Oxford and Cambridge and the older red brick universities. I don't think there's hardly such a thing as a bad university degree in England. I think it's almost inevitable though, talking about the US and the UK, that if you extend access, if you make it easier to get in, then almost inevitably there's more pressure to reduce standards. And
I think that's true.
I'm not against extending access, but you have to realize what the price is. If I may say so, I think that what you've done in the United States is transfer the rigor from the bachelor's degree level to a higher degree level. And one can understand and encourage that, because I'm very concerned at the moment in the UK. Because of the government's financial policy, the number of university places has been reduced this year and will be reduced again. Now, the result of that, there are two results of that. One is that the standard of entrance to the universities this year is probably higher than it's been ever. And the kind of points system we have for young people taking the equivalent to your 12th grade means that more and more points are being asked for entry to universities and polytechnics this year. So in 3 years' time, we should have an incredibly good set of first degrees.
But David, in addition to your old line universities and the new ones that were brought in with very rigorous standards and so on, you have in the last 20 years created some other kinds of institutions beyond what we in this country would call the high school. And you have broadened education opportunity tremendously in Great Britain in the last 20 years. Isn't that true?
Oh, it is true. We've developed institutions called polytechnics. We became very concerned that we only had two kinds of institution, universities and technical colleges. Yes. So we converted some of the technical colleges into polytechnics. Now, they do university level work, but much on a much more applied basis, and they concentrate much more on first degree than on research. But even there, the financial situation this year is limiting the number of entries. And what I'm concerned about very much is that as we squeeze the opportunities for traditional higher education in the UK, we should extend the number of alternatives for those who can't get in. Because I agree very much with John Caldwell that we must expose as many people as possible to the educational process at some stage.
Let's talk about that for a moment. There's been a good deal of unpleasantness lately in and about London. Young people unable to find work, expressing themselves violently, tearing up cities and towns. How is education in Great Britain going to respond to that? Is that essentially a problem of the educators? Where do we put the blame?
Whether we consider it's a problem of the educators or not hardly matters. Everybody else is expecting us to produce a response. And of course, it wasn't just London and it wasn't just the big cities. It was quite small towns, all suffered the same kind of thing. The root of the problems are, I suppose, that it's all very well excluding people from the higher education process as long as they've got something else to go and do, that is to say, work. When work is taken away as well, then the young people who are not a part of the academic elite and can't gain employment then find themselves in this terribly frustrating position. They usually turn out to live in very bad environmental conditions. They're very often immigrants. So you get a combination of factors. What is happening, though, is that both the Education Service and the Manpower Services Commission, which is part of our Department of Employment, are stepping in with fairly massive programs to put on additional courses at colleges, technical colleges, what you would refer to as community colleges, because they're rather more than technical, and also in work experience schemes and so on. But we as an education service are very much involved in it. Just a little irony to let you know that foolish things can happen everywhere. Having two major government departments concerned with this area of work means that I have to work as a college principal with two government departments, and I have to turn normal students away because the education department can't give me enough money to put a normal accredited course on, for example. But I can then bring those students in through another government department on a non-accredited course. And another little irony about that is that if they come to me through the education service, they don't get any financial assistance while they're doing their course, which leads to a qualification. If they come on the other stream, not only do they not get a qualification, but they actually get paid while they're not getting it. The national average for staying on at school at 16 in England is only about 33%, as opposed to your 80 or 90, yours is meant to be officially, I think, 100%, but no doubt there are dropouts. Only 13% go to university at 18. And all the time we are creaming people off. And once people have reached that kind of position on the pyramid, they're not all that anxious to hand somebody up. We are breaking things down. We're breaking things down much more in terms of class, but England is still a very class conscious, I wouldn't say class ridden, but a very class conscious society, and that's reflected in our educational provision. But it all comes back to the kind of thing we were talking about earlier on. The tradition in the British Empire was that you appointed a generalist to rule about half of India, and as long as he'd got a first-class honours degree from Oxford and a rowing blue, he needed no more training whatsoever. Now, I must say, there was a certain amount of truth in this, but I don't think it's really applicable. And I very often take as my model in the operations in my own college the American ethos, because I don't know whether I mentioned this before, but I really do believe in the development of the dignity of the individual, and I think many of society's ills would be eased if we all thought that way. And there are all kinds of things attached to that, in the sense that I believe people should be givers and takers. Now, certainly in Britain in the last few years, we've divided society into those who take and those who give. So I'm concerned to use the education service to bring people back into a giving position and a taking position. Now, one of the reasons I'm so keen on that concept is it removes these artificial barriers which young people later find in work. If the shop floor technician has been to the same college as his classically trained managing director or his university trained accountant, there is less likely to be misunderstanding. And we're a nation of two kinds of snobs, traditional snobs and inverted snobs. But you know, there are actually working class people who would much prefer their children went to do a vocational course at Tech than go on to research at a university. And by unifying the institutions of 11th and 12th grade and vocational, we remove that inverted snobbery. And that snobbery.
David Moore, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, is principal of Nelson and Colne College in Lancashire, Northern England. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently sponsored a discussion of philosophy and public policy, issues of concern such as medical and legal ethics, civil rights, and affirmative action. Soundings now presents an excerpt from that conversation. Speaking are William Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center, George Schur, a scholar at the center and a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont, Stephen Kahn, associate director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, and James Rachels, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham.
Now, you had a debate raging in this country. Well, the debate is still going on about affirmative action. George, this is a topic which philosophers, a number of philosophers, took up. Affirmative action is a difficult question of public policy. Lots of people have talked about it, have weighed in on this question. What have been the main lines of debate or discourse about this topic taken by philosophers? How have they looked at this question?
Anybody who's morally sensitive, I think, has two different reactions at once, in a way, about the practice that pull in exactly two different directions. That on the one hand, you don't have to look very hard at social conditions in this country to realize, first of all, that there are a great many inequalities in the sorts of positions people have and how much wealth and income people have and so forth. And second, that many of these inequalities are either direct or indirect results of unjust action, unjust activity, discriminatory activity in the past against members of groups that were, for one reason or another, not favored, blacks and women, I suppose, being the two most usual examples. So you look at that situation, and one reaction you have, I think, is, gee, that's not right. It shouldn't be that way. People shouldn't discriminate, and if the results of discrimination have been injustice, then something should be done about it. Something should be done. And there's a certain rough justice, in a way, in reversing the discrimination. People have discriminated against blacks or women, and if that's how we got into this pickle, then it seems the right thing to do is to even things out by discriminating in their favor now. That's one reaction that a lot of people have had. You can see why. Another reaction that people have had that cuts in exactly the opposite direction is, wait a minute, that's not exactly fair to some others. Namely, it's not exactly fair to those who, because of reverse discrimination, will be denied positions or jobs or positions in educational institutions that otherwise they would have been best qualified to hold. Aren't we doing the same thing to these people that was originally done to the victims of discrimination? Aren't we just discriminating in reverse? And isn't it a case of righting one wrong by committing another wrong? And how do two wrongs add up to a right? And I think that's another reaction that again has a great deal of initial force. And what makes it philosophically interesting is that you can't buy both reactions. If you say that it's only right or only just to even things up, then you can't say at the same time that two wrongs don't make a right here. So something's got to give. And I think what philosophers have done is to explore both of these avenues and try to see what does give, try to see what takes precedence here, and why.
I mean, which of these seemingly two correct arguments, contradictory arguments, will outlast the other? Which, on inspection, is gonna hold? Is that what they've done?
That's right.
Now, I hope that they've done better on the second one than to say two wrongs don't make a right, because I can't see much reason to buy a book that says that. I mean, we know that from, you know, our mother's knee up. So what more do they say?
Okay, that's an elaboration of the view that reverse discrimination is just as wrong as discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way that's been followed through, I suppose, is that it's led philosophers to ask some other questions, some prior questions, which are pretty interesting in their own right. Namely, this practice of discrimination by race or by sex that we all take for granted is wrong. Exactly what's wrong with it? Because until we have figured out what's wrong with that practice, I think we're not in a position to figure out whether preferential hiring in the other direction shares whatever makes it wrong.
Okay, what's wrong with it?
Well, here are some possibilities. One possibility is that it's wrong because it violates a right that the person who is best qualified for a job or best qualified for admission to some educational institution has to the job or to the position. If the best qualified have a right to be taken, then there's something terribly wrong with not taking them. It's part of what we're saying when we say that somebody has a right to something is that it's not morally permissible to deny the person that thing just because it will produce some social benefit in order to deny the person a right. So that's one possibility. Another possibility, maybe a bit weaker, is that although the best qualified person doesn't have a right, nevertheless, by virtue of superior effort, harder work, longer investment of energy and resources, that person may deserve the position. Again, if the best qualified person deserves the position, then it seems we're doing something wrong denying the person the position. A third possibility is that it may be that what's involved here is some principle of fairness. It may be that even when someone hasn't particularly done anything to deserve being the best qualified, nevertheless, some more abstract principle that everybody should be treated fairly or the same in some sense suggests that if the person is best qualified, then the person should have the position. Now, whichever one of those you favor, I think you have to... Well, all right, here's a fourth possibility. A fourth possibility is that the best qualified person doesn't have a right to the position, doesn't deserve the position necessarily, and doesn't even have claims based on fairness, but simply that society will function most smoothly or most efficiently, that social benefits will result if we give jobs or positions to the best qualified, because then the jobs will be done most efficiently. Those are four competing answers. Each of them has its proponents. Obviously, which answer you give to the question, why should we take the best qualified, is going to have a direct bearing on the question of whether the best qualified has a right to complain, is entitled to complain, when bypassed in favor of someone who belongs to a group that's been discriminated against in the past.
George's presentation of the problem is particularly interesting, I think, when one considers what philosophy can contribute to questions of public policy. Perhaps because it suggests the complexity that's immediately introduced into an issue when philosophers get hold of it. Sometimes people expect philosophers to give the answer, to provide the analysis, such that given that, the problem is solved. But in fact, what philosophers are more likely to do is to suggest that some of the key terms involved in the dispute have not been sufficiently clarified, that there are some hidden premises in people's arguments. George would go on in his discussion to raise questions about the nature of rights, indeed about the nature of persons. And as this develops, you're apt to get the reaction from someone saying philosophers delve so deeply into things they never find their way out. Well, what is the answer, George, might be the question. And George isn't ready to give an answer, but what he is ready to do is to lead you on a systematic analysis of the issues. And invariably, this is complex. It causes you to think harder about the problem, to notice some possibilities you hadn't noticed before. And this perhaps is why people view philosophy as a somewhat strange subject, in that it seems to be technical, to be difficult, and they wonder why can't philosophers speak in a straight fashion and just give us the results.
Well, the philosophers don't have answers. If philosophy is a technical discipline, as you say, where did the notion come from that philosophers do have answers? Gregory Vlastos once commented on this radio program that it was practically impossible to keep Socrates out of the marketplace, that he wanted to be there, and presumably because he had something to say about the way people behave. Now, if philosophy, as you say, is nothing but a technical discipline, then why is it that people have this notion that philosophers somehow or other should have some answers, as well as some analyses?
Yeah, I don't think it's strictly correct to say that philosophers don't have answers, actually. The particular question, what's wrong with discrimination, I think it's very hard, and I'm not sure I know what the answer is, but I'm pretty sure that I can rule out some of the options.
Well, George, you're talking about individual cases, at least I get that sense. How is it that people can look to philosophers for some sort of a philosophical temperament or an atmosphere out of which right answers will come? In other words, is it impossible to depend on philosophers for policy? Is there just no simple connection between the two?
There's no simple connection. There might be a complicated one. My own view of the matter is that it varies from problem to problem.
But then people are going to say, well, we can't depend on you. If you're going to reduce it to single examples, what good are you?
Well, look, suppose there are 10 problems, and suppose I tell you I can't solve all 10, but there's one that I can help you with.
Mm-hmm.
That's better than none. Wayne, often I share your kind of pessimism about whether a philosopher can answer a particular question in a way that really is satisfactory in the terms of the question, not whether the philosopher's answer is going to be listened to by anyone, but simply whether the philosopher can really make any intellectual progress. And I think oftentimes we just bang our heads against a wall. I know I do. On the other hand, what's the alternative to thinking philosophically about these issues? I suppose you've got a policy that's problematical, like affirmative action, and you have these conflicting intuitions. And a philosopher tries to sort out the intuitions and just keeps getting in deeper and deeper until finally maybe he's over his head. Okay, maybe that's bad. What's the alternative? The alternative is to think less deeply about it and let the arguments on the various sides go unexamined. That seems unacceptable.
Jim, yeah.
Do philosophers have answers? Sure they do. I'll even tell you where you can find the correct answer to the question about the rightness or wrongness of reverse discrimination. You can find it in an article written by George Shearer in Philosophy and Public Affairs a few years ago. But look, there's a difference between the kind of help you can get from a philosopher about a question of public policy or a question of morality and the kind of help that you can expect on a problem of, say, sewage disposal. And there's a very deep reason why, in a certain sense, a philosopher's answers don't come to you in the same way that an engineer's answers come to you on, say, a question of sewage disposal. You have a problem with sewage disposal. It's a real problem. It's bothering you. Can you get rid of that problem by just turning it over to the engineers and letting them handle it? Yes, you can. Turn it over to the engineers. Don't have to think about it anymore. You have a real problem with reverse discrimination. Can you handle that just by turning it over to the philosophers and letting them handle it? No, there's a deep reason for that. The reason is that if you simply turn over practical problems to other people, let them make the decisions, you cease being a moral agent. You cannot simply allow other people to make your decisions for you where moral, practical questions are concerned without yourself ceasing to be a moral agent. Now, it doesn't matter to us whether we are engineers. If we let the engineers take care of those problems, that's fine. They're the engineers, we're not. But we can't say, let the philosophers handle the moral questions because they're moral agents and we're not. We can't just abandon, so no one can abandon the role of moral agent. That's why you can't just turn over practical issues to the philosophers. So philosophers have answers. You can listen to what they say. You can get help from them. You can learn to be a philosopher yourself in thinking these things through. And you can learn from other philosophers how to do that.
Yeah, but you, well, what you've just said is that nobody should hand over problems to a philosopher. They should think about them themselves. But that isn't the question, why do we take special pains to hand our problems over to philosophers?
Well, there's no conflict there at all. What you have to do is to distinguish between letting a philosopher think it through as far as he can and let you in on the results of his deliberations on the one hand, and on the other hand, asking the philosopher not only to think it through, but also to make your decision for you as a result of what he's thought through. Quite obviously, you can let philosophers think it through, read what they have to say, and make up your own mind. Mm-hmm. And it's that Jim, I think, is rightly saying, mm-hmm. that any moral agent, autonomous moral agent, can't avoid doing.
Can't avoid doing his own thinking.
Sure.
About all these questions.
Sure. The easy way to show that is that to hand the decision over to a philosopher is already to dispose of it in a certain way.
As a practical man, I have to object to that. Because you obviously have to. There's not enough time in the day. You can't think about all these questions. You have to hand some of them over. When you hand some of them over, you ceasing to be a moral agent on those. How do you pick them out? I mean, I sell insurance. Now you're telling me that I have to think about all these questions too, or otherwise I lose my moral agency?
I think that the quick answer to the question is yes. Anytime you decide not to think through a problem, leave it to someone else to solve, as far as that issue is concerned, you're not functioning as a moral agent with respect to that issue. Now, because you don't lose your status as a moral agent in the mm-hmm. world unless you sort of habitually and regularly take that attitude on every issue that comes along. But where important matters of fundamental public policy are concerned, I think you have to take a position on your own as a moral agent.
It also seems true that there must be moral principles that govern when we give over authority to other people. It's one thing just to wash your hands of the whole affair. It's another thing to say, well, this decision is not so morally weighty, and the other person that I'm giving it over to is trustworthy enough, and that's a moral judgment that I make, but on this occasion I give over authority to that person.
You've been listening to an excerpt of a discussion about philosophy and public policy recorded at the National Humanities Center. The speakers were Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, George Schur, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Vermont, James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me for Soundings. The program this week consists of conversations about currents in higher education on both sides of the Atlantic. Is education in Great Britain elitist? How critical is the decline of American educational standards? A second segment this week on Soundings deals with philosophy and public policy, focusing on professional ethics, civil rights, and affirmative action. I hope you'll be listening this week for Soundings.